Hello and welcome to the Yale Press podcast addendum interview with Russell Korobkin, author of Stem Cell Century, Law and Policy for a Breakthrough Technology. I'm your host, Chris Gondek. This is the full interview conducted on November 6th, 2007. An edited version was originally part of the November 2007 edition of the show. Russell Korobkin, thanks for taking time to talk to Yale University Press today.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Your book, Stem Cell Century, Law and Policy for a Breakthrough Technology, looks at both the current and future legal and policy issues surrounding stem cell therapy. Let's start with policy. Given that we're still in the beginning stages of political discussions about this technology, how would you characterize the reasoning behind the main political positions regarding human embryonic stem cell research?
Well, that's a very interesting question, because it's hard for me to know exactly where the where people's positions come from, but of course, the main battle that you've read about a lot in the media over the last several years has been about the question of whether it's ethical to do research that requires the destruction of five-day-old embryos to create embryonic stem cell lines. And I think, you know, roughly the battle lines on this question are drawn by whether you think that a five-day-old embryo has the same moral worth as a what I call a person, right, someone after they've been born like you or I. And if you do believe that an embryo has the same moral worth as a person, then it's quite logical to oppose any research on embryos that you wouldn't think would be permissible on people. I think the better view is that a five-day-old embryo, while it might have some moral worth, does not have the same moral worth as a person, and therefore it experimentation to try to find cures for some of the most terrible diseases that we have today is quite justified. But I think that's the touchstone of that argument.
In your book, you you take a look at both the Bush administration's reasoning behind their decisions regarding human embryonic stem cell research, and then the current position of Congress. Are there perhaps some, I guess I want to say, some leaps in reasoning that really don't make sense when you look at them closely?
Well, yeah. So I'm quite critical of President Bush's policy on federal funding of embryonic stem cell research. But I'm also critical, as you allude to, of the bill that Congress has passed twice now and has been vetoed twice by President Bush. So President Bush's reasoning has a number of problems. Let me touch on one, which is that if you really believe that an embryo, a five-day-old embryo that doesn't have any consciousness, it doesn't have any neural structure, it doesn't have any of the types of abilities that we think of as humans normally having, it only has human DNA. If you think that embryo has the same moral worth as a person, then logically you ought to oppose allowing anyone in our society to do research on that embryo. But the Bush policy only concerns federal funding. President Bush has never suggested that he would support a law that actually made it illegal to do research that destroys embryos. So that's just one of the ways in which the president's policy is internally inconsistent, not just even if you agree with his premise about the moral worth of embryos. On the other side, Congress has twice passed a bill called the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act, and of course been very big news when the president twice vetoed that bill. And that bill would allow federal funding of research on any embryos as long as the embryos are extra embryos from in vitro fertilization clinics. That is, they're the embryos that were created when a woman or a couple went into a fertility clinic to get in vitro fertilization, but then were ultimately not used as in the in vitro fertilization process. But the Stem Cell Research Enhancement Act would not permit federal funding of scientific work where scientists might create an embryo specifically for the purpose of deriving stem cell lines for research. And the idea here is this distinction between discarded embryos and created embryos. And I think that there's this, that when you first think about it, you may be tempted to think that there's a moral distinction between using an embryo for research that's going to be discarded anyway and creating one for the purpose of doing research. But I think that this reasoning is flawed because all of the extra embryos that are created in vitro fertilization clinics don't need to be created, strictly speaking. In vitro fertilization clinics could create embryos only at the number that they're going to actually insert into a woman's uterus to try to produce a baby. But they create lots more embryos than they need because then they can choose the best ones, and that increases the likelihood that the patient is going to succeed in getting pregnant. Now, I'm not against this in any way. I think this is perfectly appropriate. Perfectly appropriate for in vitro fertilization clinics to do, but what it suggests is that we routinely create embryos knowing that they're going to be destroyed, because we know that the number of embryos that are created for in vitro fertility treatment are not all going to be implanted for the purpose of trying to commit a baby. If that is acceptable, and again, I think it is, but if you think that's acceptable, then it doesn't really follow logically to say scientists should not be able to create embryos in order to create stem cell lines for the purpose of stem cell research, which, again, this is not just for the fun of the scientists. This is a technology that has a tremendous amount of potential to perhaps cure many of the worst type of degenerative diseases that affect nearly every family in our society in one way or another.
Before I move on to these questions about the development of the industry, because that's really, I think, a lot of part of the book are the legal and some economic questions around how the industry will develop. You spent a chapter talking about cloning, and I think that is another, one might say, hot button issue for people, because it's easy to create the visual image of scientists cloning human beings as reproductive cloning. Could you talk about a little bit about how your book views cloning and what are the issues around it that maybe people haven't thought about?
Yeah, so the most important thing is a first step for people to understand is the difference between reproductive cloning and therapeutic cloning. So both start the same way. So these two things are, these two types of technologies are related in that both start by taking the nucleus out of an egg and replacing the nucleus with an adult cell from a person, like, say, a skin cell that could come from your arm or my arm. And then convincing the egg to believe and behave as if it had just been fertilized by a sperm cell rather than had its nucleus replaced with an adult cell. If you can get the egg to do that, to start behaving like a zygote and to start the process of cell division, then you can, in fact, create an embryo using this technology. Now, at this point, this is where therapeutic and reproductive cloning depart ways rather drastically. So reproductive cloning would entail taking this embryo that's created in this way and inserting it in a woman's womb for the purpose of trying to create a baby. Almost all Americans are opposed to reproductive cloning. And this includes all of the political leaders, both Democrat and Republican. And it has nothing, and reproductive cloning has nothing whatsoever to do with stem cell research. What stem cell researchers want to do is create an embryo in that way, but then use that embryo to create, not a baby, but to create embryonic stem cell lines that, again, will be used for research, just in the same way that these leftover five-day-old embryos from fertility clinics can be used for research in order to try to learn more about and hopefully find a cure for degenerative diseases. So because therapeutic and reproductive cloning share this method at the beginning of the process, there's a lot of confusion with anti-stem cell research activists claiming that stem cell researchers are doing cloning or want to do cloning. And that's true in a sort of in a trivial rhetorical sense, because it's, I think, not improper to talk about therapeutic cloning as a form of cloning, but it's not cloning a person. It's just cloning a cell for the purposes of research. So that's what stem cell scientists want to do. And the reason that they want to create embryonic stem cell lines through the therapeutic cloning process is because then, in theory, you could use that process and start with a cell from someone who has a particular illness that you're trying to cure, And then if you can create a stem cell line that can be used to help treat that illness, then you won't have the problem of immune system rejection of those stem cells, because the original cell that you've cloned has the same what they call HLA profile. That's the same protein profile as the cells that in the body where those that stem cell line is going to be used for treatment, and you won't have to put the person on very serious and very dangerous immunosuppressive drugs like we have to do when somebody gets an organ transplant today. So this is a very important link in the process by which we hope to go from laboratory research on stem cells, which is what we're doing now, to hopefully one day, 5-10 years down the road, move into the clinic and be able to actually use stem cells to treat people. But this confuses a lot of voters when people start bandying about the term cloning. So I think the issue here is that if you think it's appropriate to use embryonic stem cells for research, then the idea of creating them, those embryonic cells, through the cloning process doesn't bring any other significant harms along with it. Again, the idea is not to create people this way. It's just to create cells this way. Now, there are some arguments that, you know, there are some plausible arguments that it's worse in some ethical or practical way. It's worse to create embryonic stem cell lines through this therapeutic cloning process. I think the best of these arguments is that it could lead us down the slippery slope towards reproductive cloning. That is, if scientists create stem cell lines through the therapeutic cloning process, then you will have embryos in laboratories, very young, 3-day, 4-day, 5-year-old embryos in laboratories, that in theory somebody could smuggle out of a laboratory and could smuggle into an in vitro fertility clinic and use to actually create a baby that would, at that point, be a clone. But in a sense, this argument really proves too much, because even if we don't permit therapeutic cloning in this country, the technology is going to be developed and perfected in other countries, and someone could just as easily steal an embryo that was created in this way from a laboratory in some other country and bring it here and smuggle it into an IVF clinic and use it to create a baby, as they could steal one out of a laboratory in this country. So to the extent that doing therapeutic cloning creates this risk down the road of making reproductive cloning maybe easier for someone to do illegally without a lot of notice coming of it, it's really not going to make it that much easier. So it really doesn't serve much of a purpose, in my opinion, to prevent it on those grounds. Now, there are, of course, other arguments. Other people object to the idea of creating embryonic stem cell lines through this process, because on the grounds that using the cloning technology to create a new embryo is in some way like playing God or exceeding our the appropriate boundaries of what people should do. But whether or not you think that this argument is accurate in terms when you're talking about reproductive cloning, it just really doesn't have a lot of purchase, I don't think, when you're talking about just the cloning of cells, because we use all other kinds of we do all other kinds of things in laboratories where we create and we manipulate and work with cells of various kinds, and this type of research is really no different than that. So that argument doesn't really hold up well either. And then also in the book I talk about some constitutional problems with banning or prohibiting therapeutic cloning, not just refusing to fund it at the federal level like we do now, but Congress has considered in the past several years a bill that would actually make even therapeutic cloning of cells, illegal in a way that Congress has not considered making embryonic stem cell research itself in its basic form illegal. And so when you talk about making things illegal at the federal level, then you raise a number of constitutional problems, such as whether you're interfering with basic rights to life and liberty that the Constitution guarantees us. And in the book, I argue, I go through these arguments quite carefully, and the bottom line conclusion is that these are not constitutional problems that are likely, given the current makeup of the United States Supreme Court, to be taken all that seriously by the Supreme Court. That is, they're not likely to be seen as making a law that Congress could conceivably pass to make therapeutic cloning illegal actually unconstitutional, according to the Supreme Court. But they do certainly raise constitutional objections that I think provide other reasons to avoid legislation that would make therapeutic cloning against the law.
What actually is the relationship between the federal government and the states in this issue of stem cell research? Because if I remember correctly, don't the states set healthcare policy?
Right. So that's a good point. So generally speaking, historically, the states have had most of the authority vis-a-vis the federal government over regulating the healthcare industry. But the federal government has provided almost all of the money for basic scientific research. States provide very little money for basic scientific research. But since President Bush's policy was implemented in August 2001, there's been very little federal funding for embryonic stem cell research. Now, I should say there has been a fair amount of federal funding for adult stem cell research, which is another promising area of research, although most scientists think it's not as promising as embryonic stem cell research. But I want to make clear that there has been federal funding of adult stem cell research, but there's been so little funding of embryonic stem cell research that a number of states have started to provide serious amounts of state funding for that research in a departure from the way scientific research is usually funded in this country. And, of course, California is the biggest and best example. In 2004, California passed Proposition 71, which committed $3 billion over a 10-year period of state funding to actually providing grants to support stem cell research. And priority is given to embryonic stem cell research since there's no federal money for that. So under the California law, therapeutic cloning is permissible, but reproductive cloning is not permissible. So again, there's that distinction that I think is sometimes lost, but it's an important distinction at the state level for the states that are supporting this kind of research on their own, just like it is when we talk about stem cell research at just sort of a broader, more abstract level.
So the monies that California gives to researchers, are those just gifts, or what's the relationship between the people that get the money in California and then the taxpayers in California?
Right. So this is a great this is a great issue that goes beyond really stem cell research, but it's the type of issue that I bring up in the book because although it's not unique to stem cell research, it's particularly topical when we talk about stem cell research. Proposition 71 includes a provision that says that the state should benefit from any successful stem cell research that's done with state funds. So the way that California's Stem Cell Agency has decided to operationalize this principle is to enact a rule that requires any nonprofit organization, including universities and university researchers, who will probably be the main recipients of grant funding, if they have a successful invention that they're able to patent and then collect royalties on by licensing out to maybe commercial manufacturers who will then take the basic research and help turn it into actual treatments for use in patients with degenerative diseases, that the grant recipients have to share 25% of the profits that they are able to make by licensing this technology after they've recovered a sort of a base level amount in order to cover their internal costs. So this means that the state is, in some sense, can be have a financial stake in the success of the research that it funds. You might compare it to what a venture capitalist might help to get out of funding research, except that the amount that a state is asking for is going to be a lot less than, especially what California is asking for, is going to be less than a venture capital firm might ask for. But it's that same idea that if someone, in this case the state, puts up money to support the research, why shouldn't that someone be entitled to some of the profit if the research is really commercially successful? And this is very interesting because it's, again, very different than the federal policy, which since 1980 has permitted scientific researchers who get federal grant money and are able to create a commercially successful product using federal grant money to keep 100% of the proceeds of that money and not give any back to the federal government. So this is kind of a new idea about public-private partnerships that was initiated here or exemplified by the California law that breaks ranks with the federal policy on this in an interesting way. And we'll see if this makes any difference. People that oppose this type of revenue-sharing plan are afraid that this will reduce incentives for people to, especially the best researchers, to take state money and use it to develop stem cell treatments. But my take on this is that having to share 25% of your profits is not too high price to pay, and most people are going to accept those restrictions without even blinking. And if a couple scientists, you know, if a few scientists out there have so much access to so much other money that they can get it with no strings attached, well, then all the better for them. And, you know, let's have them take that other money and use that rather than asking for money from the taxpayers.
So finally, next year, 2008, is a presidential election year here in the United States. What are you looking for?
Well, in terms of stem cell policy, there's it really has not been debated as much in the primary season as I would have liked to see. So you have a situation where on the Democratic side, all of the major candidates say that they're opposed to President Bush's funding restrictions, and they are in favor of loosening those restrictions and funding stem cell research. On the Republican side, and probably for that reason, because all the Democratic candidates are aligned on that, there hasn't been much discussion about any details beyond that. On the Republican side, the candidates seem to be about split. About half seem to be supporting, at least half of the major candidates seem to be supporting the president's policy, saying that they're opposed to funding research that has the consequence of destroying five-day-old embryos. Whereas Rudy Giuliani and John McCain, they've come out in favor of lifting the president's funding ban so long as, and here's this distinction that I mentioned before, the discarded versus created distinction. Giuliani and McCain say they're in favor of federal funding, but only of embryos that are excess embryos from IVF clinics. They're opposed to funding research where scientists would create embryos just for research purposes. So interestingly, the Democrats, at least to my knowledge, I haven't heard any of the major Democratic candidates say whether they favor maintaining that discarded versus created line that I've explained a few minutes ago that I think is quite an illogical place to draw the line. I haven't heard any of the Democrats talk about that line. And I would like to see candidates come out not just for overturning the president's policy, but also for a more pro-stem cell policy, also coming out in favor of a policy that would allow federal funding based on the scientific merits of the proposal. That is, no discrimination against research just because it involves stem cells, regardless of whether the stem cells that would be used would be taken as excess from IVF clinics or would be created in a laboratory by scientists. Again, I think it comes down to this basic point that if you think that people like you, like me, that are walking around alive, persons that have the ability to, that have consciousness, that have sentience, that have emotions, if you think that we have more moral value than five-day-old embryos that have human DNA, but other than that don't have any of the indicia of being persons, then I think that it follows that you should favor research that could potentially greatly reduce human suffering for people that have degenerative diseases. So I'd like to see, before the election next year, I hope that the candidates will speak to this point. Another point that the candidates that I would like to see the candidates speak to, that no candidate has spoken to, is only partially related to stem cell research. It's really a quite larger question about what the standards are for granting patents by the Federal Office of Patent and Trademark Office. There's an argument that's been going on for the last couple of decades about whether the United States grants too many patents for too many things based on too many inventions that really shouldn't deserve patents, that really are not of the type that should deserve patents. And as a result, that can slow down scientific research, because if there are too many patents for too many things, then it becomes very hard to do further what you might call downstream research that uses that patented technology, because you have to go back and you have to find out and you have to negotiate licenses with lots of people further upstream that own patents. So as I said, this is a larger issue, but it's really important in stem cell research right now because the U.S. Patent and Trademark Office has granted patents on embryonic stem cells, period. Not on the process of creating embryonic stem cells, not on the process of keeping embryonic stem cells alive for study in a petri dish, but actually on the cells themselves. So as a result, the University of Wisconsin, where the first human embryonic stem cell lines were created a decade ago, claims that they actually own human embryonic stem cells. And if you want to do research on human embryonic stem cells, even if you create the stem cell lines yourself in your own lab using embryos that you've been had donated to you from a fertility clinic, the University of Wisconsin says you have to get their permission to do your research. You have to pay them a fee, and you have to agree to follow all of their terms and conditions. And these are patents that, in my opinion, shouldn't have been granted. It's not a problem of stem cell patents in particular. It's part of a more general problem of the pro-patent forces holding sway in the patent office and in the federal courts against arguments that would make more technology available in the public domain, make less technology patentable, and would then make it easier to innovate downstream. And in this case, when we're talking about innovating downstream, we're talking about making it easier for scientists to use embryonic stem cells in order to create with them, cause them to differentiate or turn into special kinds of adult or directed cells that could then be used as inputs into medical treatments.
Well, Russell Korobkin, author of Stem Cell Century, Law and Policy for a Breakthrough Technology, thanks for being on the Yale Press podcast today.
Chris, thanks for having me. Enjoyed it.
And that was Russell Korobkin talking about his book, Stem Cell Century, Law and Policy for Breakthrough Technology, which is published by Yale University Press. For more information about this and other titles, go to the website, www.yalebooks.com. Copyright 2007, Yale University Press, all rights reserved.